Knowledge Products presents The Giants of Philosophy, Jean-Paul Sartre, narrated by Charlton Heston. Part 1.
Just after the end of World War II, in September 1945, a new literary magazine appeared in Paris. It was called Le Temps Moderne, Modern Times, a name borrowed from the title of a Charlie Chaplin movie. Its editors were a group of young French writers committed to social critique and reform. These writers faced a country humiliated in war, compromised and demoralized after 4 years of occupation, and without respected intellectual leadership. But they sensed a revolutionary opportunity. They thought it was time to produce a new kind of literature and criticism, what they called an engaged literature. The moving spirit and editor-in-chief of the new magazine was a 40-year-old philosopher, teacher, novelist, and playwright named Jean-Paul Sartre. In the first issue, Sartre spoke for himself and all his associates.
Our intention is to work together to produce a certain changes in the society that surrounds us. By that, we do not understand a change within the soul. We happily leave instruction of the soul to authors with a specialized clientele. For us, who, without being materialists, have never distinguished the soul from the body, and who know only an indivisible reality, human reality, we ally ourselves with those who wish to change both man's social condition and the conception he has of himself.
Sartre was already known to his countrymen. He'd published a number of philosophical books and one well-regarded novel before World War II. His huge philosophical treatise, Being and Nothingness, begun while he was a prisoner of war, had appeared in 1943. And he'd produced a number of successful plays during the war, notably The Flies and No Exit. Sartre was one of a number of well-known writers, including André Malraux and Albert Camus, who'd been active in the resistance against the Germans and thus commanded broad public respect. All these men were committed to making a political difference in the post-war world, and each would have a formidable influence on French thought and life. With the war nearly over, Sartre was ready to make his move. Events helped to catapult him into the public eye. Camus, then editor of the resistance newspaper Combat, asked Sartre early in 1945 to be a political columnist and make a visit to the United States. He did, writing back his controversial views of the dangers for France of American power and American culture. These views, Sartre never changed. In the fall of the year, two of his novels, The Age of Reason and The Reprieve, were published to considerable acclaim. Sartre and his intimate friend Simone de Beauvoir were constantly pictured together in the newspapers. Her second novel had just appeared. Everywhere there was a cry for fresh thinking. Political programs and social visions were being floated from the Catholic right to the communist left and all points between. So Sartre and his friends launched their new magazine. Within a few months, Le Temps Moderne and its editor established themselves at the center of intellectual and political debate in France. Almost as suddenly, thanks partly to Sartre and his magazine, a new philosophical ism appeared in the scene. Existentialism took its position in philosophy, opposing both idealism and positivism. Idealism emphasized the mind and spirit over material things, and positivism insisted that only the empirical methods of science can produce valid knowledge. Now, existentialism provided a new way of thinking. It directly confronted human existence. In Sartre's hands, it entered the political arena as well, opposing both Marxism and the religious right. The elements of existentialism had been around for some time in the works of theologians and philosophers, and the name existentialist had been applied to some French writers like Malraux, Camus, and de Beauvoir. Sartre himself had been described as an existentialist. Still, no one quite knew what it meant. Somehow, existentialism conveyed a willingness to see the evil in life and recognize that human beings are responsible for it. It seemed to challenge people to fresh initiatives. So it rapidly became a watchword for many in the post-war generation, an intellectual force not only in France but around the world. Our goal is to explain the meaning of existentialism as Jean-Paul Sartre defined it. Sartre's most accessible statement of his ideas is found in a lecture he gave at almost the same time he started the new magazine. It was October 28, 1945, at the Club Matignon in Paris. Sartre later had misgivings about the way he'd put things in his lecture, but when it was published, it crystallized the popular meaning of existentialism. He spoke very directly.
Not only is man what he conceives himself to be, but he is also only what he wills himself to be after his thrust toward existence. Man is nothing else but what he makes of himself. Such is the first principle of existentialism.
Sartre tried to explain to his listeners that existentialism isn't some gloomy, pessimistic doctrine, even though it confronts the evil in human life and is boldly atheistic. Existentialism doesn't say that human beings are reasonable or good, that we can count on progress or anything like that. Nonetheless, Sartre insisted in his lecture that existentialism is a kind of humanism. It encourages a positive view of the possibilities for human life.
When all is said and done, what we are accused of, at bottom, is not our pessimism, but an optimistic toughness. If some critics take exception to our works of fiction, in which we write about people who are soft, weak, cowardly, and sometimes even downright bad, it's not because these people are soft, weak, cowardly, or bad. Because if we were to say, as Emile Zola did, that they are that way because of heredity, or the workings of environment, or because of biological or psychological determinism, our readers would be reassured. They would say, well, that's what we are like. No one can do anything about it. But when the existentialist writes about a coward, he says that this coward is responsible for his cowardice. He's not like that because he has a cowardly heart or lung or brain. He's not like that on account of his physiological makeup. But he's like that because he has made himself a coward by his acts.
According to Sartre, there's no such thing as a cowardly constitution.
There are nervous constitutions. There is poor blood, as the common people say, or strong constitutions. But the man whose blood is poor is not a coward on that account. For what makes cowardice is the act of renouncing or yielding. A constitution is not an act. The coward is defined on the basis of the acts he performs. When we say this, people feel, in a vague sort of way, that this coward we are talking about is guilty of being a coward. And the thought frightens them.
Existentialism thus seems to threaten and attract people at the same time. It criticizes the way we live by saying we cover up our freedom with all sorts of excuses. But it also takes the optimistic view that we can change. As Sartre put it,
there is always a possibility for the coward not to be cowardly anymore.
It's not hard to see how such a doctrine immediately found a response in post-war France. After the German occupation of France in World War II, every Frenchman in some way felt compromised. People needed to be able to feel both guilt and the possibility for renewal. This has been the appeal of existentialism ever since. Sartre continued his lecture by emphasizing that existentialism is not actually a popular ideology at all, much less a scandalous one.
It is the most austere of doctrines. It is intended strictly for specialists and philosophers. Yet it can be defined easily. What all existentialists have in common is that they think that existence precedes essence.
But what on earth does that mean? In order to explain this formula that existence precedes essence, Sartre asked his listeners to consider some object that's manufactured, a book or a paper cutter. You might consider any natural object, too, like a flower or a horse. Each of these things is defined in terms of certain given traits and functions. In philosophical parlance, each of them has an essential nature, an essence. And what these things are, how they actually exist, is measured in relation to that given essence. In this way, an object's essence precedes and judges its existence. All we have to know in order to decide whether we have a good specimen of a paper cutter, or a flower, or a horse, is whether it properly fulfills its essence. Does the paper cutter cut? Does the plant grow and flower according to its species? Does the horse neigh and run? It's easy. Find out what the essential nature of something is, and you can judge it. But Sartre declares, with man, it's different. Man has no essential nature, no essence. There is no common human nature which tells us in advance what it is to be a man in the ethical sense. This is what it means to say that for human beings, existence precedes essence. Sartre continues his lecture.
It means that, first of all, man exists, turns up, appears on the scene, and only afterwards defines himself. If man, as the existentialist conceives him, is indefinable, it is because at first he is nothing. Only afterward will he be something, and he himself will have made what he will be. Man is, at the start, a plan which is aware of itself, rather than a patch of moss, a piece of garbage, or a cauliflower. Nothing exists prior to this plan. There is nothing in heaven. Man will be what he will have planned to be. Thus, existentialism's first move is to make every man aware of what he is and to make the full responsibility of his existence rest on him.
This is the thesis, then, that a human being chooses and makes himself, herself. Each man is responsible for what he becomes. But there's more. Sartre says each of us is also responsible for all men. What does this mean? Since your choices are yours alone, and since there's no way you can define what's good for anyone else, what could it possibly mean to say that each of us is responsible for all men?
When we say that man chooses his own self, we mean that every one of us does likewise. But we also mean by that in making this choice, he also chooses all men. In fact, in creating the man that we want to be, there is not a single one of our acts which does not, at the same time, create an image of man as we think he ought to be. I am creating a certain image of man of my own choosing. In choosing myself, I choose man.
This doesn't mean that you or I actually prescribe values for anyone else or that we choose for them. We can't do that. But it does mean that our choices have an ultimate importance. Sartre says, it's as if all mankind had its eyes fixed on me and were guiding themselves by what I do. The point here is that you or I can't just act with nothing more attaching to it. I can't just do as I please without creating vast consequences. In doing what pleases me, for example, I'm inevitably saying, this is the sort of person I am. I'm saying that I value this sort of life, in this case, the life of someone who simply does as he pleases. And I'm responsible for it, whether I like it or not, as Sartre puts it.
At every moment, I am obliged to perform exemplary acts.
Each of us is creating human values. Our responsibility, therefore, is great. In doing whatever we do, each of us gives to human values, images, and ideals the only status they have in the world. We can't appeal to anything outside ourselves to support our choices. We're responsible, so we must agonize over our choices.
Man is anguish. We find no values or commands to turn to which legitimize our conduct. So, in the bright realm of values, we have no excuse behind us, nor justification before us. We are alone, with no excuses. This is the idea I try to convey when I say that man is condemned to be free.
In this lecture, Sartre illustrates the anguish of freedom with a story drawn from his experience in World War II. It concerns a young man, one of his students, who came to him for advice.
The young man's father was on bad terms with his mother, and, moreover, was inclined toward collaborating with the Germans. His older brother had been killed in the German offensive of 1940, and the young man, with somewhat immature but generous feelings, wanted to avenge his brother. His mother lived alone with the young man, very much upset by the half-treason of her husband and the death of her older son. The boy was her only consolation. The boy was faced with the choice of leaving for England and joining the Free French, that is, leaving his mother behind, or remaining with his mother and helping her to carry on. He was fully aware that the woman lived only for him, and that his going off, and perhaps his death, would plunge her into despair. He was also aware that every act he did for his mother's sake was a sure thing, in the sense that it was helping her to carry on. Whereas every effort he made toward going off and fighting was an uncertain move which might run aground and prove completely useless. So he was wavering between two kinds of ethics. On the one hand, an ethics of sympathy, of personal devotion. On the other, a broader ethics, but one whose efficacy was more dubious.
The boy has to choose between the two, but how can he? Christian ethics can't tell him how to choose. That says, love thy neighbor. But whom should he love as a neighbor? The fighting man or his mother? Kantian ethics can't tell him. That says, don't treat anyone as a mere means. But either way, he treats someone as a means. Which course of action would do the greatest good? But there's no way to tell. No book of ethics can tell him which is better, the vague act of fighting in a group or the concrete one of helping a particular human being to go on living. Since values are vague, maybe the only thing left for the student is to trust his feelings. This is what he's trying to do when he comes to visit Sartre. But how can the young man determine in advance which is the stronger, more trustworthy feeling? He can't. The only way he can tell is after he chooses. His choice will tell him which emotion is stronger. It'll be the one he follows. Nor can the student simply ask an advisor. He will have picked the advisor. Indeed, Sartre notes that the student knows very well what advice Sartre will give him.
You are free. Choose. That is, invent. No general ethics can show you what is to be done. There are no omens in the world. The Catholics will reply, but there are. Granted, but in any case, I myself choose the meaning they have.
This story captures the spirit of existentialism. Existentialism is a call to us to be aware of our freedom and of our responsibility to choose. But beyond this, as Sartre's student discovered, we find no instructions for our lives.
This is the end of part one. Please download part two to continue.